Now we're gradually coming out of lockdown. We can meet up outside in groups of up to six or two households. Have friends round for a drink in the garden. There you are, doing your bit, keeping a safe distance. When it starts to get dark and a little chilly, and suddenly your lounge looks very warm and inviting. But don't forget, you're much safer in the fresh air because COVID-19 particles are blown away. Let's take this next step safely. Remember, hands, face, space, and fresh air.
Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast by NHS Providers. My name's Adam Brimelow, and this is the third episode of our COVID-19 One Year On series. This time, we're looking beyond the immediate pressures of the pandemic to its legacy, where it's left the NHS, its workforce, the mental health impact, the inequalities it's exposed, the innovation it's driven, collaboration, vaccinations, and of course the treatment backlog. I'll be talking to Professor Stephen Powis, NHS National Medical Director, Patricia Miller, Dorset County Hospital NHS Foundation Trust Chief Executive, and Sam Allen, Chief Executive at Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. We also have Chris Hobson, Chief Executive of NHS Providers. You can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers, and keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you. In this edition of the Provider Podcast, we're looking beyond the pandemic, but I think the first thing we have to acknowledge is the pandemic is still very much with us. So we know infections, admissions, COVID patients in hospital and deaths are all down, but we still have a lot of patients with the virus in hospitals and many more living with long-term physical and psychological symptoms from the disease. There's the impact on the NHS workforce, exhausted, often traumatized. There's the backlog of care, including a mental health legacy which can't yet be quantified. There's way COVID has widened health inequalities, the disproportionate impact on areas of deprivation and on people from Black, Asian and minority ethnic backgrounds. We know so much has been accomplished by the NHS during the pandemic, but no question, huge challenges lie ahead. And I'd like to start with concerns around the NHS workforce. Stephen, how concerned are you about burnout and its impact on what the NHS needs to do next, given the scale of the challenges ahead?
Well, hello, everybody. And as you said, Adam, the NHS has gone through a remarkable year. I'm sure the toughest that people working in it will ever have faced. And I'm sure they will remember it for an awful long time. And it's been relentless, hasn't it? It's been a series of challenges that we've all had to face in very many ways over the course of well over a year now, because we went into a level four incident, if you recall, at the end of January 2020. We had the first wave and the first peak in April. We didn't know what that was going to be like, but the NHS coped magnificently. Then we had the period over the summer and into the autumn recovering, and then unfortunately into a second wave, which for some parts of the country, the north hit in November, and then for the south really hit, particularly with a new variant that was identified before Christmas, really hit in January. So my sense is that large numbers of staff are tired and exhausted. It's been a really long haul over the last year. Many of them, I think, probably around, you know, almost one in five perhaps, have been working at some point outside their normal areas. And that's quite tough when you're working in a setting that you're not used to. Sure, it can be fulfilling, but it also gets tiring. So I think one of the key tasks at hand will be to support our staff. We clearly have to recover services again, as we started to do in the autumn, but service recovery is really only going to happen with staff recovery. And the final point I'd make is that I'm aware it's also a mixed picture. There will be surgeons, for example, who've not been able to bring their patients in and who are worried that they have patients who need treatment. So the stresses and strains are different for different groups. Some are tired, exhausted. Others are waiting to go. But we really have to have that holistic approach. And that's why in the planning guidance that was issued recently, people was right at the start of that. It was the number one thing that we focused on in terms of helping organisations help their staff recover.
Sam, what's the situation in your trust? Are you seeing worrying signs of burnout among your workforce?
I think when I talk to colleagues right across the service, Adam, we are hearing what Stephen's described. You know, staff are tired. There is and has been certainly some distress in the workforce, particularly given what they've gone through over the past year, the loss that they've seen, the bereavements, loss of colleagues, loss of family members, extraordinary hours in extraordinary conditions. So now more than ever, we absolutely need to look after our workforce. I think as Stephen describes, it's a mixed picture right across the service, both in our hospitals and all of our community teams. People continue to go to extraordinary lengths, but I think where we see great teamwork, where we see support in the workplace, where we also see staff accessing the health and wellbeing hubs that have been set up, I think that's where we stand our greatest chance of supporting the workforce to recover within a reasonable period. But we need to remember that everybody's experience is personal. People will recover at different rates. And whilst a colleague may look fine today, they may not look fine in a few months. So certainly the legacy of this significant incident is going to be with us for some time to come. And it's really important that we continue to support our staff to access the support they need, when they need it, and in a really timely way.
So we were hearing about the priority given to workforce wellbeing in the planning guidance. Patricia, how satisfied are you that there is enough support being put in place to help things through over these coming weeks and months?
So I think I agree with some of Steve's points around the fact that the key to some of this is balancing the recovery of staff with the recovery of service. And in some areas, not going too hard and fast, that means we're not taking the staff with us. I also agree with many of Sam's points around recovery will be individual, and we need to consider what external support is required, as in what the organisation can provide. But I think the biggest key to recovery will be, one, recruitment, because we're asking people now to deliver on a recovery of service when the NHS was already constrained for staff and had huge vacancy levels. So workforce supply will be absolutely critical. And also getting the balance right between the support that organisations can provide and the value of the relationships within teams, because that single thing for me is absolutely critical to their recovery. It's about the closeness of their relationships. It's about whether they feel cared for and cared about by colleagues within teams. That is an important part of recovery for staff. It's not all about what the organisation can do for them.
I think, Adam, that Patricia's point about the need to effectively not only provide short-term support, but also remember that fundamental underlying mismatch between the demand and the capacity, that was the problem we had before COVID. It's still there. It's been very clear over COVID. And until we can get to a sensibly sized workforce, then however hard we work to support people, if you've still got that capacity demand mismatch, we're not going to have this right. So that's a bit that we really need to get right.
Can I just get on to the wider mental health consequences of COVID and the lockdown, affecting obviously staff, but also wider society? Sam, as chief executive of a mental health trust, what's your sense of how well equipped we are to deal with this?
Well, if I think about the way the NHS has responded to COVID-19 over the past year, I think the first thing I'd want to say is there's no organisation I'd rather be working in. Having said that, mental health is everybody's responsibility and it goes far beyond the NHS. And what we do know from various studies that have been undertaken is that people's mental health has generally been worsening during this period, particularly impacted by things like social isolation. And as a mental health trust, our own service users, particularly those with a severe and enduring mental ill health, about 75% of them would report a worsening in their mental health. So that coupled with increases in domestic abuse, increases in financial insecurity, unemployment, and if we just start to really think about the increase in caring responsibilities, whether it is caring for children, young people or adults, there's absolutely no doubt about it, Adam, that people's mental health has been impacted. And to some extent, we need to accept and understand that is a consequence of the pandemic. So what we don't want to do is over-medicalise our response to it, but root, I think, the vast majority of what we do in community work, working with our communities, our local authorities, our voluntary sector organisation. Again, it's a bit similar to the impact on staff's wellbeing. We need to understand that this has had an impact on everybody right across our communities. And as the days get brighter, we need to retain our hope and optimism, and we need to support our communities to care for each other. And I think, again, over the past year, they've really demonstrated what they can do. So the work doesn't stop, it just continues. But we have seen an increase in things like eating disorders and the impact on severe eating disorders during this period. And we do know that our mental health colleagues at the moment, whilst the infection rate has gone down and the number of people who are COVID positive in hospital have gone down, they're working incredibly hard dealing with the pressures around mental health at this point in time. We really do welcome the recovery plan that was published just within the last few days for mental health, which is very much needed.
And Patricia, the pandemic has underscored health inequalities, disproportionately affecting people from Black, Asian, minority ethnic communities and areas of deprivation. What role do you see the NHS has in responding to that?
I think it has a significant role, and the pandemic has shone a light on health inequalities, but we already knew they existed, and I think we weren't paying enough attention to them, if I'm honest, as a service. When I think back to the reason why Bevan established the NHS, it was all about reducing health inequalities, and we've lost our way a little bit. For me, I think, yes, the NHS has a critical role, but it can't do it on its own. The work and the partnership that is required through the ICS is essential in order to make inroads into inequalities and deprivation. But I also think the NHS has a task of its own in that it cannot focus on health inequalities and make a significant difference in that space while it's not focusing on inequality within its own organisation in terms of its people. For me, the two go hand in hand. Individuals that don't understand what inequality needs to look like inside can't engage in the right conversation outside. I also think that we need to, in terms of delivering the ICS and its ambition around health inequalities and being a partner to social and economic development, we need to think very differently about the way we deliver service. And again, that will require a significant culture change. It will require a different leadership offer in terms of developing services that are no longer based around institutions, but actually put communities and citizens at the heart and probably at the front of decision making around what barriers they're experiencing in well-being and good health outcomes, and us being able to respond to that in a way that is meaningful to them.
Stephen, clearly health inequalities have really come to the fore, haven't they, as an issue and concern, priority for the NHS in ways that we haven't seen before. How confident are you that the NHS can use its scale and reach to really make a tangible difference quickly?
Well, as Patricia has said, health inequalities is something that we have known about for many, many years. Various Marmot reports and other reports have highlighted this over the years. And indeed, it was a central feature of the long-term plan that was published just over 2 years ago. So as others have said, the pandemic has really shone a harsh light on something that we already knew about. My experience of working in this is that the really tough thing is to design interventions that make a difference. And it's, I'm not going to say it's relatively straightforward, but identifying health inequalities, you know, we do a lot of that. What we need to move to increasingly in the NHS is ensuring that the interventions that we make, the programs that we design, really think about whether they're going to shift the needle on this at inception. So, for instance, I'm the lead for cardiovascular and respiratory disease in the long-term plan. And as we design our programs, and in those areas, again, you see health inequalities, you're much more likely to have a stroke or heart disease if you're in particular communities. Trying to design into some of those programs that we're working on right at the start, a targeted approach to reduce that gap, that's the tough thing. And that's the thing I think that the NHS really needs to concentrate on, where it can make a difference, ensuring that this is thought about at the start in well-designed programs rather than a sort of afterthought at the end where we look to see how we've done.
Can I just have a quick word about social care? I think the pandemic has really highlighted the long-standing neglect of social care, really at a terrible cost. Chris, how has that impacted on the NHS and where do we go next?
I think for me, what's happened over the pandemic is that whenever you talk to chief execs, they say about how effective the collaboration has been. But fundamentally, there is an underlying fragility about the social care sector, which is really, really difficult. And we need the government to deliver on that promise. They keep making. Blair made it, Cameron made it, Theresa May made it, that effectively they would reform social care. And it's not just about reforming personal payment arrangements, still not caps and all that. It's actually about the fragility of the workforce. It's about the fragility of the underlying provider market. So it's really, really important that the government plays its part. But also, I think it's very clear that the opportunity provided by moving towards system working is that we can, in the NHS, help our social care colleagues to genuinely create an integrated health and care system. But, you know, it can only be done on the basis of having a less fragile social care system.
One of the big priorities set for the NHS, as we saw with the recent planning guidance, is to deal with the backlog, particularly of elective and cancer care. Patricia, how worried are you about this, and how quickly, realistically, can the NHS be expected to make significant headway?
Alongside staff recovery, this is my biggest concern leading an acute trust. I think I'm old enough to remember when waiting lists were this size previously, probably in the Blair days, and how long it took us to recover that position and the level of investment that was required. So I'm not expecting this to happen overnight, and I probably think the NHS needs to be reasonable about the length of time it's going to take to recover waits to a reasonable level. And in my mind, we're probably talking 3 to 5 years. The concerns, I think, fall into a number of buckets. Those that are already on waiting lists that potentially could be experiencing harm while they're waiting. Patients who on the diagnostic pathway will very likely drop into an elective waiting list after either 18 weeks or cancer. And then we've got the unknown, which are people who are still sat outside the organisation, who have not been referred in by their GP because they've not made contact with their GP during the pandemic because they've been worried. And for me, those are the areas where I'm most concerned about. If we get a bounce back of GP referrals at the rate we're expecting across the NHS in the next few months, that could exacerbate the situation even more. So in my mind, there's a number of things that need to come together in order to be able to tackle this. There's a workforce challenge. Again, workforce supply will be absolutely critical to create capacity to be able to move services into a place where we're comfortable and waits are at a safe level. I think we've got huge amounts of validation to do, as always, to make sure that people on the waiting list actually need the treatment that they were listed for. Funding will be a huge challenge because this is going to be expensive. The partnership with the independent sector will be absolutely critical. And also how we use capacity flexibly across ICSs in a way that adds value to patients. Because when we look back in previous years, when we have had waiting list challenges, the type of big bang solutions that we've put in place have actually exacerbated health inequalities rather than addressed them, because we've chosen solutions that for affluent mobile communities are easy to access, and for those that are more deprived and maybe rural, like the community I serve, are not so easy to access. So we need to think again about how we recover services through that health inequalities lens so that we're starting to deliver services in a new way. I also think that some of the innovations that we've seen through COVID, we need to hold on to. So some of the moves to surgical hubs, which are more efficient, some of the innovations within cancer alliances where we've seen prioritisation hubs that have made best use of capacity available to patients so they don't have to wait an extended period of time, have worked really well. And I think we need to hold on to some of those innovations as we move forward.
You talked about innovations, and we've certainly seen some incredible innovation during the pandemic. Stephen, what do you think are the best new approaches that you think will stick for the years to come?
Yes, as Patricia said, in the task of recovering services, we need to be innovative. And we definitely need to hold on to those innovations that have come out of the pandemic, where they either show benefit to patients or benefit to staff, or of course, ideally benefit to both. And there's been a real, you know, range of different innovations that we've seen. I think the flexibility that staff have shown around working in different areas, although, as we said earlier, that can be stressful, it can also be positive. And so I think one of the things that we need to think about going forward is how we maintain some of that flexibility so that some of it becomes the norm rather than the exception. The digital innovations that we've seen, I think, are going to be important to hold on to. Again, the long-term plan set out an aspiration to move from the traditional outpatient model, for example, through to one that was much more flexible, and many appointments can be done without people having to come up to hospitals or outpatient settings. And again, we saw that move rapidly during the pandemic, not just, of course, in secondary care, but also in primary care. I think the figures I often quote are that at the start of the pandemic, around 5% or so of GPs had video consultation as a sort of part of what they did regularly, and that's gone up to well over 90% by the time we got through the first wave. So I think baking those in to the recovery where they are appropriate, where they work and where they have benefit, is going to be an important way of getting through these waiting lists. The final point I'd make is, again, something that Patricia's hinted at, which is the diagnostics part. An awful lot of the weights in some of these pathways are around the diagnostic phase. And of course, during the pandemic, Mike Richards looked at and produced his report on diagnostics, and a move to diagnostic hubs, for instance, I think will aid in the recovery.
Sam, are there any specific innovations in mental health that you think will be especially useful in dealing with the sorts of challenges we now face?
Yeah, I think the digital innovations have been really positive. And if I think about electives, and we talk about cancer, we talk about musculoskeletal, I think one of the legacies of this pandemic will it'll bring the access issue for elective mental health care right to the fore. And again, if we think about children, young people who have responded really well to the use of digital during this period, I think that will be a legacy. I think one of the other things we've also learned over the last year is the point around digital inclusion. It doesn't work for everybody, and certainly there's more we need to do. If I was to say for the NHS, I think one of the things I think we need to do is retain our boldness. I think we've been really bold over the past year. We've reduced bureaucracy, we've had really swift and clear decision making and much better communication. So I would like to see that continue. And I think, as Stephen has said, if we can harness the flexible working, the more hybrid models, we're much more likely to retain our workforce, because this is indeed, I think, the modernisation they've been seeking. But I think also when it comes to recruitment, whilst we are pursuing international recruitment initiatives, now's the time we need to be bold and plan for the long term for our own domestic supply. We need to be expanding training places even further in local institutions to build our own domestic supply of workforce right into the future. And I think at a time when a lot of people across our communities will be thinking about changes in careers, whether or not it's because they've been made redundant or indeed the industry they work in has taken a decline during this period. And I think about the retail industry, for example, we need to retain our boldness as a health service to plan not just for the short term over the next year, but for the medium to long term as well, if we're ever to get out of the cycle that we're in at the moment when it comes to workforce supply.
So we know the pandemic has been happening against a background of a movement towards system working. Chris, what has the pandemic shown us about new partnerships and collaboration and integration?
Well, I think they've speeded up that process. And there's a very interesting debate, isn't there, about how much does the move towards more collaborative and system working, what the factors that most make that happen at speed? Are they the legislative changes that we're, and the structural, organisational structural changes that we're all debating? Or are they actually that sense of needs must? We absolutely have got to do this to keep our patients and our communities safe. And I think my view would be that what's more likely to speed up the move to collaborative working is the experience of the last year. Certainly what really strikes me, Adam, is that whenever we speak to chief executives and leaders, as I was saying earlier, the single message they keep saying to us is how much the experience of the last year has speeded up system working. And to be frank, I mean, my view of this is that if you look at what we've got coming down the track in terms of the extra levels of demand we've got, the care backlogs that we've got, the kind of extra mental health demand that we're seeing, the reality reality is that we can't carry on trying to meet them using the existing ways of doing things. The only way we're going to be able to do them is actually if we're much more innovative, of which system working is definitely part of the situation, but there are actually other things that we need to do, like the move to digital, like the things we've been talking about in terms of different models of getting through more diagnostic tests more quickly, etc. So I suspect the NHS is going to be forced to be more innovative if it's going to get through what it needs to get through.
Well, let's look ahead to what the NHS must do to adapt to the reality of COVID being with us probably for years to come. If we look first of all at vaccinations, the possibility, the likelihood of annual vaccination programmes, that's going to be a huge undertaking that needs to be factored in, isn't it, Stephen?
Yes, well, I think the first thing to say is something I often say, which is we're still learning about this virus. And we're still learning around how these vaccines will work, how long immunity will be generated when you have those jabs. And of course, we're also seeing new variants now. That's not unusual as viruses adapt, particularly in the early phases when they're adapting to a new host, i.e. the human population. So I think for this autumn and winter, there are a few questions that remain outstanding. There's a question about the variants, there's a question about the immunity, and it's going to be a few months, I think, yet before those sorts of answers to those questions crystallise. But perhaps a central assumption would be that in the autumn, some in the population, perhaps not all, again, that needs to be determined by JCVI and others, will need to have a booster. And if that's the case, then it may well be a booster that is directed against one or more of the new variants that we're seeing. Again, a question that needs to be answered in the next few months. But our planning is assumptions are that this autumn, we are going to have to maintain the momentum of the vaccine programme. And of course, we're going to have to do it at the same time, probably, as the flu vaccine program. So we've been thinking about what that looks like, whether those two programs, if the COVID program occurs, will be simultaneous, whether they'll be overlapping. We will see in the next few months. And of course, in there, there's another scientific question, which is whether you can give the flu jab and the COVID jab at the same time. And that's a subject of clinical research at the moment. But clearly, if we did have to deliver the two programs, a jab at the same time for both would operationally, and of course, from a convenience point of view, be a lot easier. So there's a whole host of specific questions for this autumn. Then there's a sort of longer term set of questions as to what happens in subsequent years. And again, we're probably a bit too early in this yet to know what that's going to be like. As you said at the start, Adam, will it be an annual COVID program? Will it need to occur at the same time as the flu program every year? Will it be a slightly different set of vaccines each year as the flu program? The flu vaccines are altered each year to deal with the expected circulating flu variants. Don't know, but it's possible and perhaps probable that that is what it's going to shape out as. So I think there's a task for this year. Obviously, great progress on the vaccine program so far, but that needs to be maintained to get everybody vaccinated, then into the autumn, and then a set of medium and longer term issues we'll need to think about. But the NHS has done a remarkable job. I think we should really emphasise this has been a spectacular success and all the staff and volunteers who've participated in this. And the final thing I'd say is whenever I visit vaccine centres, I'm just struck by the huge enthusiasm. Everybody wants to do this because it's the way out and people really know they're making a difference.
And Patricia, the pandemic has imposed a new reality, hasn't it, in terms of infection control, for example, in hospitals. And that's something that the NHS is going to have to manage and live with for years to come, probably. What is the impact of that, looking to the future in the way that you operate?
To be honest, Adam, I don't think we know what the future is going to look like yet. The impact through the pandemic obviously has been quite intense in terms of staff experience because wearing this level of PPE, particularly in COVID positive areas, leads to dehydration and a whole range of issues. So staff have needed quite a lot of support taking them through the pandemic from that perspective. When we look at the future, I think one of the NHS's strengths is infection control practice, if I'm honest. It's the reason why we've got some of the lowest hospital-acquired infection rates in Europe. It's something that people recognise as being important. Compliance levels are really high. I think our bigger issue will be the reconfiguration of estate going forward so it meets the infection control standards that may be required if we're going to have to live with this pandemic in the long term and how we adapt facilities to be able to meet those standards. And particularly when we have a number of capital ceiling constraints in the NHS, how do we balance priorities across systems to make sure that we build new estate with the right standards in terms of infection control, because this will, even if we don't live with this for the long term, this is not going to be the only time we're going to face a pandemic like this, I don't think. So we've got to make sure the estate of the future is compliant, but also how we adapt our existing estate so that the infection control standards can be delivered.
And Sam, I should imagine estate renewal, adaptation, that's going to be absolutely key in the mental health realm as well.
Yes, it really is. I mean, certainly the trust I chief executive of, we've got 9 hospitals and 101 community sites. Not one of those was designed to operate in a COVID-19 world. So the adaptations we've put in have been temporary. And one of the things we're thinking through now is actually how do we build some of these in for the long term? I was talking to a mental health trust chief executive who was just in the final stages of building a new inpatient hospital for children and young people. They actually went back to the drawing board. So they've incurred a cost of just over £1 million to make sure that actually that new build does build in COVID-19 requirements. We really need to think about what is the environment we need for the future delivery of healthcare, not just in terms of infection prevention and control, but a more hybrid model, use of digital. I think this is really requiring us to think much broader than just COVID-19, but it's a good opportunity for us to think about much more flexible working environments and environments for our patients. You know, what is the future? 3 to 5 years, Stephen, would we be self-administering our vaccinations at home? You know, I think the science and the technology is moving so quickly. So we really do need to be re-envisaging the NHS for the future.
Just given how things stand now, Stephen, how optimistic are you that we can progress to a situation where we have buffer capacity in the health service that is going to enable it to withstand future challenges of this kind?
Well, I think there's probably two parts to that question. There's an immediate part, which is how over the course of this year, perhaps next year, we'll have to see we retain the ability to flex and perhaps surge again if we did get a future wave. Now, very hopefully we won't. We've got a great vaccine program. As you said at the start, we're seeing admissions and numbers of people in hospital. As I stand today, it's around just over 3,000 in type 1 hospitals. We've seen that reduce dramatically since the peaks in the 30,000s in January. But we do need to keep an eye on that. And obviously with new variants and other things, there's a task of work over the course of this year that as we're recovering, that we maintain that flexibility to treat more COVID patients if we have to. And again, that was in the planning guidance, wasn't it? I think there's then a medium and longer term question, which is how do we take the lessons out of this and think about if there was another pandemic or another emergency of this nature, we would deal with it. And I think there's a number of areas we would need to think about. So the estates issue is important, as we just heard. And indeed, on the new hospital programme board that we have working on the new hospitals that the government's committed to, a couple of questions I've been putting and thinking about is that infection control question. How can we make sure that the estate of the future is correct for our infection control challenge, but also for our flexibility and in order to flex estates into different ways of working? But I think the intensive care and the critical care facilities are another area that we really need to think about. So clearly, we've seen a lot of mutual aid. We've seen a lot of surging into areas that are not existing critical care areas. And we need to think about how we might need to deal with that again if there was another pandemic. And that's not just about estate. It's again back to what we've been talking about. It's about different ways of working. So one of the things that we've learned about in this pandemic is that we don't have to have everybody ventilated on an ITU. There are ways of managing oxygen needs that perhaps don't require that level of invasive mechanical ventilation. So how can we ensure that our intensive care facilities are both capable of surging, but also capable of that flexibility? So lots of questions, Adam, but we haven't got the answers yet, but we absolutely need to be thinking about these for the future.
Professor Stephen Powis, Patricia Miller, Sam Allen and Chris Hobson, many thanks for taking part. Great to talk to you. Best wishes to you and your teams for the mighty challenges ahead.